At Subway, start 2010 right with surprisingly low-fat choices. The Piled High Subway Club or Turkey Melt, fresh toasted under bubbly cheese. Both are part of a Subway Fresh Fit meal, a simple way to enjoy eating better. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Not often that we have a guy who wins awards, but we have one today. Jason Reitman, director of Up in the Air. You're not in the Subway Fresh Take Hotline because you're in studio. You're right here. What's happening?
I'm doing great. You?
Tell us about the Golden Globes because you just went. I've always wanted to go. Is it more fun or less fun than it seems like on TV?
Well, how does it seem on TV to you?
Like people are kind of borderline getting drunk, but they can't really fully let loose, but they definitely have a few in them. And then as the night goes along, it gets a little more loose and a little more inebriated, but you know the parties will be even more fun.
That's interesting. You know, I don't know. My table certainly was a sober table. You know, no one was getting plastered over the night, even though, you know, we had two supporting actresses in the film. And their award was first up. So
right.
I kind of felt bad for them because they basically, the show starts, they find out that Monique won and that's it. Now they just got to kind of sit through this whole thing.
And then they found out they lost not only to Monique, but that she didn't shave her legs that day. I don't know if you saw the pictures.
Wow. Yeah. No, I haven't heard about this.
Yeah, she did not shave her legs.
Well, she's a method actress.
Apparently.
No, I mean, it was wonderful, and I was very much under the impression that it was not going to win. Kind of everyone had told me as much that...
The writing award?
No, that Quentin was going to win, and that I really should just kind of enjoy myself and enjoy the evening. So, went in, and when they announced screenplay, I was really caught off guard, and we went up, and Sheldon spoke first, thank God, because that gave me an opportunity to, actually come up with something to say, and then I accepted the award, and everything got really quick. You know, I've been drunk maybe 10 times in my entire life, and that night my wife and I went to the first after party and just made a mutual agreement that we were going to get hammered immediately.
Nice. And did you hold the award the whole time?
Oh, yeah. No. I did what I've seen in the photos. Like,
right.
I just used the award like a divining rod and let it take me wherever I wanted and wherever it wanted. And we went to 5 parties. I was very drunk. I took a photo with Mike Tyson. We just went out all night and had a blast. And then the next morning, I realized what happens when you accept an award in front of a few hundred million people. You know, people generally don't recognize me. That's one of the beauties of being a director is
yep.
that you have kind of a certain modicum of fame, enough to kind of get into things you might not otherwise get into. You get certain opportunities. But for the most part, people don't bother you. They don't know who you are. And
well, but you do get bothered a little because people think you might be Sasha Vujicic, although he did cut his hair.
Yeah, exactly. I used to, yeah. People used to think, wow, Sasha Vujicic is a lot shorter than I realized.
I thought he was 6'4". What's happening here?
I get you look like Dave Grohl. You look like Jason Lee, but never you are Jason Lee.
Right.
And but the morning after was the first time I literally, you know, went out for breakfast with my family and, one person after another kind of recognized me from making my speech last night. I presume that'll only last a few days, but that it is kind of an unreal thing speaking in front of that many people on television.
I would imagine. And so what happens? Your heart's pounding? Does everything go white? Or do you have like some sort of semblance of control over what's going on?
You know,
really?
For some reason, speaking at the Golden Globes was easier than speaking at the Broadcast Critics Awards, which happened 2 days earlier. When I was at the Critics' Choice Awards, I was very aware that I was on television, and it was on VH1, and I don't know how few people saw that. Probably not that many, but still, for whatever reason, I was conscious that I was on TV, and I was very nervous. At the Globes, it's in the Beverly Hilton. I grew up going to bar mitzvahs in that room. You know, like,
right.
I'm very comfortable in that hotel, and I knew most of the people that were in that room. And for whatever reason, I got it into my head that, okay, I'm talking to people I know.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk to the actors. I'm going to talk to my parents, I'm going to talk to my wife. And I just kind of looked at each of them and said things that meant something to me. And it was really only after I realized, wait, you just talked on television to a lot of people. And
well, you know, it was funny. And I know this wasn't the case because I know you a little bit at this point. Mm-hmm. When Cameron won the Best Director Award, they cut to you and it looked
right.
like you were like furious.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I've been getting this back and I really wasn't. Well, here's two things. One, I kind of knew he was going to win, so...
Obviously. I mean, the Golden Globes, they kind of gravitate toward...
Well, yeah, and I just... I was under the impression that he was going to win director, and Avatar was going to win picture. So I kind of knew that was going to happen, and it's just so funny, because I have gotten this kind of chatter back about me looking, like, ill when they won, when I kind of knew they were going to win. And so I went back and I watched it, I thought, wow, what did I look like? And I don't think I looked that weird, like... Quentin certainly looks just as upset, if not more upset, than I do. I think he had thought he had more of a chance than I did of winning. So I'm really honestly confused by this. But yes, everyone seems to think I looked really upset.
I kind of thought you looked like you smelled a bad fart.
You know what? Well, that's the truth, is that someone had farted near me. highlight of the night, by the way, was at some point the guy who won for Glee talked about he said, this is for everyone who's gotten a wedgie before in their life. And Paul McCartney was 3 feet away, and he asked his girlfriend what a wedgie was.
He didn't know what a wedgie was?
No. I don't. Maybe they don't have wedgies in London, in England.
They did, Paul McCartney's probably not getting one.
No.
I'm guessing.
No.
I think they just have, I think people just get beaten up. In England, you just get punched.
They just brawl. Around. But yeah, it was kind of cool. You know, what's a wedgie? And then you know, his girlfriend did the motion with her hands, and you're like, oh yeah, that.
Now, were you? I mean, this Jeff Bridges thing kind of gained momentum the last month. I thought I saw your movie before it came out.
You do a sports podcast? We seem to be doing now like a complete award.
Well, no, happened.
No, I'm just having fun with you. I'm just having fun.
No, listen, I saw your movie before it came out. And I thought Clooney's going to win all the Best Actor awards. I just thought people like Clooney. This was kind of the ultimate Clooney movie, him being himself. And this was going to be so often happens in award season. The guy gets rewarded, not just for the movie, but for his career. Here, this is your time, George.
Right.
And this Jeff Bridges thing came out of nowhere. And, now it looks like Clooney probably is not the favorite anymore for the Oscar. Right?
You know, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. First of all, the Oscars are over a month away, and a lot can happen in that time. They both had great performances, frankly, this year, and I could understand why people would vote either way. You know, the tricky thing with George's performance is that it's hard to recognize how difficult it is to do that performance.
Right.
And that there is a tendency within voting to go for a performance that is bigger and has more melodramatic opportunity. And that's not to take anything away from what Jeff Bridges did. He's beautiful in that movie, and that is a great film, and I really enjoyed it. But it's easy to overlook how difficult it is to do what George did, and that is to be in real pain underneath and to show confidence at the service, to do many things at once, and to be as charming as he is while showing a certain sense of subtle vulnerability. That's actually the trickiest acting you can do. My films are filled with that kind of acting. I'm always kind of directing actors to do that kind of stuff, and I'm very proud of the work they do. Sadly, it doesn't get, you know, recognized. I don't think, you know, Vera and Anna are never going to get recognized as much as Monique, and be, you know, George's performance may get overlooked from time to time because people think, oh, that's just what George does. It's easy. Overlooking how difficult it actually is to do that.
Do you judge... You know, when you talk about awards, and we don't have to talk about this year in general, but just everything. Is it harder, or does the Academy judge that it's harder to do the over-the-top performance or the nuanced performance? You seem to think the nuanced doesn't get enough credit.
Well, look, only because I direct these kind of performances do I know how tough it is to do. But look, I think it's actually kind of something you brought up earlier. People catch a wave. And it just kind of happens, you know, like Daniel Day-Lewis, whatever it was, last year or 2 years ago.
Yeah.
They just catch a wave and you can just feel the momentum going for them that people want to award this person. Because at the end of the day, how can you actually differentiate five performances, five films, five, you know, works of direction or writing? they're often very different types of films. There's no way to quantify whether it's not, again, it's not the Super Bowl. There's no score at the end of the day. So you look for other things to guide your voting. And what happens is certain people kind of just catch a wave where you want to honor them for their work. And it may be not only the film that they're currently in, it may be the group of films, it may be where they are in their life, too. And it makes you go, you know what, it's time to celebrate this person, and it just happens.
And that's kind of what I thought would happen to Clooney, but I didn't even see the Jeff Bridges thing coming, because he's one of those guys, I like comparing actors to athletes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Which I've done many times. And he's one of those guys that you're like, you never really think about him that much, but then you go and look at your at his IMDb and you're like, oh yeah.
Right.
Oh. And then you realize like, oh yeah, this guy had a really, really good career, but when's the last time you had a Jeff Bridges discussion?
Right.
You know, and it seems like that when you're talking about that wave, that's part of this wave with the performance is not only was he great in that movie, but it's kind of people having that epiphany of,
right?
And, oh yeah, Jeff Bridges.
It's funny. I mean, because it speaks to how strange film awards are.
Yep.
In general, in that there is no way to quantify whether someone deserves an award or not. That there is a business behind it, in that these awards are good for the films that that are awarded. You know, Jeff Bridges is in a tiny film right now called Crazy Heart that most people have not seen. It's a wonderful film. Him winning will determine how much that movie will make. Just the fact that he won over the weekend has boosted their box office already.
Yeah.
And if he were to win an Oscar, certainly people are going to go see that film that otherwise never would. So there's also kind of a business driving these awards. And look.
Well, and also with your film, people know about it. People have seen it. It's not fun to say, you know what movie you have to see? Up in the Air. Because you're not breaking news. If I tell people at dinner, you got to see that Clooney movie Up in the Air, like, yeah, we saw it. We know. We already know about the movie. But if I say at the dinner,
I would think that there's a large portion of your audience,
yeah,
that has still not seen Up in the Air. And I implore,
I would hope that's not true.
I implore them
movie.
To do so.
But like if I said at dinner, you know what movie I just saw?
Moon.
Movie called, oh yeah, Moon. That's another good example. Moon, Sam Rockwell. Oh, you haven't seen it? Oh my God, you got to see it.
Right.
And then you get to do that whole thing. And I do feel like in award season, a lot of this stuff is determined by the passion of people telling other people, you have to see
yeah.
that versus, oh, you probably already saw it.
Well, it's funny because I make these kinds of films, the films that people want to take ownership over, that are usually discovery films. They start at a film festival, they start small, they grow. And
Juno, that definitely happened.
That was certainly with Juno. And the funny thing with the discovery film is that because people want to take ownership of it, once they can't take ownership of it, that is, I think, what leads to the backlash.
They get mad.
And yes, yeah. They get mad. And I have now experienced both sides of it. I've experienced that moment on a film where people want to take ownership and they love it and they want to tell all their friends about it. And then, and on Thank You for Smoking, we kind of plateaued there and never got to the backlash. On Juno, we got to the kind of other end of it when all their friends have seen it four times, and now it is their job to hate the film.
Well, the screenwriter, too, I think became polarizing to some degree, Diablo Cody,
mm-hmm.
where people were like, you know, she's so anti-Hollywood. Who is this? Why is she? Why do I have to hear so much about her? And then there was all of a sudden, she's overrated.
And it's
next
so funny
that was a
because
great script.
It's so funny because she has no control over this.
Yeah.
You know, if people are going to talk about her, they're going to talk about her. She's a lovely woman and really smart and a great writer, by the way. And it is so funny to kind of read this stuff, go back and forth on her, back and forth, because I kind of consider her to be a sister, and I want to be very defensive. But really, this is just stuff you can't control.
Remember that stammering question that I asked like four questions ago where you basically just reiterated what you'd already told me?
Which one?
I couldn't remember the question that I had, so I blanked, so I just basically babbled, and then you got you to talk in. I remembered what I was going to say.
Okay.
I think the Oscars or any awards, it should be the same way that I feel about the NBA MVP,
mm-hmm.
where not only is it a great performance, but you also have to flip it around and say, all right, who else could have played that part?
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think we do enough with awards. And I look it up in the air, and as you said, nuanced, but I really don't know who else could have played that part.
Neither do I.
Who else pulls it off? I feel like I thought Jeff Bridges was amazing in Crazy Heart. But I feel like a few other actors could. That was a really good part, and you grow the beard, and you have the cigarette voice, and
Well, look, I think that's one of the elements that speaks to all the performances in my film.
Yeah.
That I don't know what actress you put in place of Anna Kendrick in the role of Natalie. I don't know what actress you put in the place of Vera Farmiga in the role of Alex. And I certainly don't know who you put in the place of George Clooney in the role of Ryan Bingham. All three of them are so singular in their ability to do what they did in this film. And I thought a lot about it, and I wrote for them. And I've had long conversations with people, because people often say, well, if you couldn't get Clooney, who would you get? I really, frankly, don't know. It would have been a much different movie.
I don't know who else you could have. I have no idea.
No, I would have honestly had to rewritten the film as a different human being.
Well, let's talk about that in a second, but tell the story about how you convinced Clooney to do it. Which I'm sure you've told before, but it's a good one.
Fair enough. You know, what happened was I started writing this film. I wrote it for a long time. And I got to meet George during the awards run for Juno. He had done Michael Clayton that year. And I started running into him places. And at one point I said, look, I'm writing a movie for you. And he said, oh, great. Let me know how it turns out. And his agent kind of kept track of it. And his agent would call me every few months, say, how's that script going? And at a certain point I said, look, I'm either a week away from done or a month away from done, but I'm going to Italy on vacation with my wife. I'll give it to you right before I leave or when I get back. And he said, well, if you're going to Italy, you should see George.
Oh.
I said, I don't know about that. That seems like weird. I don't really know the guy. I've met him a couple times. He's like, no, he loves having guests at his house. You should go over and go stay with him. I said, I don't know him. You want to stay in his house? Frankly, what if he hates the script? He's like, oh, he's going to love it. I said, well, how about this? I'll get the script to him, and if he likes it, I'll go stay. And he goes, okay. So my wife and I were in Italy. We're on vacation. I called the agent. I said, look, did you read it? Should we go? He's like, yeah, go to the house. Sure. Yeah, here's the address. This is how you get there. When you get there, you talk to this person. I'm like, okay. So follow these directions. We drive out to his house. And when we get there, he's not even there. We get there, and we show up, and there's this kind of person who works at the house, and he's showing us around, and all of a sudden we hear, rum, 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 and in comes George on a Harley. And we start talking to him, and within an hour of us being there, he asks me, so what are you working on these days?
Oh, no.
I'm like, well, there's this script that you got is up in the air. And he's like, oh, right. I got to read that. I know that's around here. And it's like, oh, no. And so now we're staying at his house. It's beautiful. And he's a very gracious host. But I'm honestly waiting for him to say, look, I read your script. That's no good. You really have to leave.
Right.
And 2 days go by. And honestly, there was one point where he disappeared for many hours. I thought, oh, God, George just ditched us. And then out of nowhere, he walked into our room and he said, I just read it. It's great. I'm in.
Wow.
That was it. It was like 6 words. It was done. And we sat down for dinner and we ate and we drank. That's one of the other 10 times I got drunk. He drank me under the table and, we drank till 3 a.m. and he just asked me about what my process was like. And we talked about filmmaking. He's a great guy to talk about movies because he loves movies and he loves movies of the '70s, which is my favorite era too. And we just talked about how he would make this thing, and he said, who are you thinking for these actresses? And I told about Vera, and I told him about Anna, and he's like, great. That was it.
Explain the process of, so you're writing these movies, and you have an actress or an actor in mind with the character that you're writing specifically for them, but what happens if they say, nah, what do you do with the character?
Well, in George's case, I really had gone a new direction, and I'm going to actually give you a BS report exclusive because people all the time ask me who would have played Ryan Bingham if it was not for George Clooney. And I actually forgot who my backup was until just recently, but I've never actually told anybody. And it's very, very different. It would have been a completely different movie.
Can I guess 20 questions?
Yeah, sure.
Is he over 40?
Yes.
Is he white?
Yes.
Was he ever on a hit TV series?
Kind of.
Has he won an Oscar?
No.
No. All right, I can't do this then. Who was it?
Really? You're done?
Yeah,
you're
out? I'm out.
Steve Martin.
Wow. I never would have guessed that.
Yeah, it was a really different... But that's what I mean, is yeah. Once it's not George, I would have completely rewritten the role and made it much more like Lost in Translation was for Bill Murray. Yeah. And that was my backup plan, was I will completely rewrite this movie for Steve Martin and give him his Lost in Translation.
What if Vera Farmiga had said no? What do you do with that character?
That I almost had to deal with, because Vera... So I write this role for Vera, and I'm so fixed on the idea of whether George is going to say yes or no. I just presumed Vera would be available and say yes, you know? Right. Frankly, you know, I saw her in Down to the Bone at Sundance, her debut film, which she's phenomenal in, and then I'd followed her career. I'd actually even met her once. I saw her in The Departed. I'd always wanted to work with her, and I just thought, you know, why wouldn't she want to... It is a good role, and... George says yes. I said, okay, great. Let's go get Vera. And Vera is 6 or 7 months pregnant. Mm. And I thought, how, you know, we shoot in 4 months. You know, basically she was going to have a baby a matter of weeks before we started shooting. This is not going to work. So I started putting together a list. I said, okay, who am I going to do this with instead of her? And I really couldn't figure that out. Because I thought a lot about a lot of women. And Vera is very unique in her approach, in the way that she does not judge her characters, and her ownership of her kind of sexuality, that she's able to be as masculine as she is feminine. And I remember meeting with Vera, and I said, you can't do this. You know, I've had a baby. You can't have a child and go right back to the work that quick. And she said, oh, yeah, yeah, I can. Mm. I said, well, you've never had a kid before. She's like, look, Jason. She, like, honestly kind of sat me down and put me in my place. And it was in that moment I said, God, you are Alex. I mean, there's just no getting around it. And I'm just going to believe in you. And she forced me to believe in her. And I'm happy she did, obviously, because she was perfect.
So when you're sketching out the characters, what's the process? Do you have, like, a notebook where you have, here are all the traits I want this character to have?
No, there's tons of writers who do that. I don't have a process like that. I just kind of know who they are. I have it in my head, and I just start writing. I'm actually about to start writing my new screenplay next week. I have a trip planned. I'm going to go out. I'm adapting this book. And
so you don't have index cards on a wall?
I've done index cards, but usually index... No, I don't do index cards for characters. Honestly, with characters, I rarely know their background. I don't know what food they like. I have a feeling for who they are. I have a good sense about people.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty good read. And because of that, I think I know my characters. And if you ask me, you know, what would they do in this situation? I could tell you. But... what's their backstory? I don't know. I can usually come up with 20 different backstories for how someone became the person they are. Like, for the amount that I know you, Bill, I could probably think of 20 different stories that would lead to you being the person you are today.
Well, why don't we announce that your next screenplay is about me? It's a semi-autobiographical.
It's the Bill Simmons story. It's a tragedy.
But I'm a civil rights crusader.
Exactly.
It's me in 1960.
Yeah.
That I got killed then. So you're starting that process next week?
Yeah.
Writing it or just figuring out what to write?
No, I got a book that I'm adapting.
Okay.
And because of that, you know, there's somewhat of an outline there. And yeah, I'm going away. I got a 5-day trip. I'm going to try to write as much as possible.
5-day trip to where?
Palm Springs.
You just hole up in a hotel room?
Yeah.
Are you nervous beforehand? Or are you like, I can't wait to write
gearing up? Honestly, gearing up. I've been
like playing a game.
I've been doing publicity for up in the air so long that nothing excites me more than going and writing something new.
You know, you just reminded me of something. I read a Clooney thing in Entertainment Weekly, mm-hmm. and he was talking about publicity and how he never does interviews anymore.
Yeah.
Did you read that? You know what I'm talking about?
It was in this last, it was like two weeks ago. It was the Oscar issue where they put us on the cover. Yeah.
And he had this really, I loved what he said. And I'm going to say this the next time my book company wants me to do a million interviews. He's like, people have already decided on me. Like, you can have me do all the interviews you want, but ultimately people are going to want to go to the movie if they like the premise or whatever. Nobody's going to say, I really need to figure out where I stand on George Clooney after movie 15.
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of things. I mean, there's a certain amount of publicity that is about figuring out who somebody is and deciding who they are. And by the way, that changes through acts of your life because you're a different person, you know, every 15 years or so. But outside of that, there's also a general awareness that a film exists. So, it is necessary to do a certain amount of publicity just so people know there is a film. It is called Up in the Air. It is in the theaters, and it is worth seeing.
Yeah.
Because if you never do publicity, ever, ever, then that becomes a problem.
You did an insane amount of publicity.
Yeah.
In fact, there's an awesome video.
Yeah.
That I really liked how you did it. It's basically a picture of everybody who interviewed you for 4 months. 3 months? 4 months?
Yeah. I've been going since Toronto, the beginning of September. So,
everyone who interviewed you, every press pass you've had, every movie ticket that you bought.
The movie tickets are actually other people's. I asked on Twitter.
Oh.
On Twitter, I went out and I asked people to send me their tickets from going to see Up in the Air.
Oh.
So it begins with me doing a bunch of press, but it ends with everyone else's movie tickets.
It's really cool.
Thank you.
I liked it. Hey, now, are you going to keep adding to it?
Or no,
are you done
that one's done. Okay. I did one for Thank You for Smoking that I'm going to repost soon. That was kind of fun. That was every airport I walked through on my publicity tour for Thank You for Smoking. But
I mean, I only did it for 3 weeks and
yeah.
Now it's a blur. I can't remember one thing that happened. It's waking up early, but I can't even imagine 3 months.
It was crazy. It was 3 months. It was international and yeah, it fried me big time.
Yeah. Cause how many ways can you talk about the same?
Well, that's why I did the pie
topics.
Chart. And I know you know about the pie chart
yes.
as well. I kept a pie chart of every question that I was asked.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been asked about George, you know, a good couple hundred times. So yeah, there's only so many times you can answer that question.
Crap. So I have to think of questions you haven't been asked yet.
Well, so far you've been very original.
How many times during the shooting did you think, I'm not gay, but if I had to make out with one guy, it would be Clooney?
You know, I don't think Clooney's my type if I were to be gay.
That's good.
I think I'd want him to be my buddy, but not make out with him.
Do you think he ever gets married? He likes who he is. He likes his life, it seems like.
I can't say. You know, he seems to have figured out his life. And it's funny because, I mean, this is a lot of what my movie is about, is the political decision to stay alone. Because it's judged by everybody. And it's never thought of as just a kind of sound, reasonable way to go through life.
Yep.
And he's found a way to do it quite successfully, where he's surrounded by people he loves. He has a group of people that he really, truly loves. And he has a very fulfilling life. He does what he wants for a living. He gives back more than anyone I've ever met. And is philanthropic in a very real way. That's not just to make him look better.
Mm.
He seems to have it all figured out.
Well, we always hear about, like, on sets and stuff, like how charismatic he is and mm-hmm. everybody falls in love with him. Like,
that's
true.
Give us
two stories that would bring that home.
You know, I'm not even sure if I have a story. I can just give you kind of details that show you how it works. One, he never leaves set. And
what do you mean?
He never goes to his trailer ever. Ever. He stays on set all the time. He loves the process. He grew up on sets as a kid. You know, his dad was in TV. And he just loves movie sets, and he never leaves. And because of that, the crew gets a sense of this guy as not someone who's there to do a part but wants to go back to his luxurious trailer, but someone who is kind of in the game with them all the time.
So he's soaking everything in, studying how you do stuff?
He doesn't have to study anymore. He knows it too well. Now he just kind of enjoys it. He enjoys the process. He likes making movies. And he gets to know people, and he's just friendly and likable and is fully aware of who he is, but at the same time, he's just a good guy.
Yeah.
And tells great stories. He's one of the best storytellers I've ever met. He's a true raconteur. And when he tells a story, he brings things to life. He does characters. He's funny. He's physical about it. He does faces. He can be a bit of a goofball, is the truth of it.
I like that you used the word raconteur.
Thank you.
It was good.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. It's a strong SAT word.
I have to come on and be impressive. I got a target on me, you know. I gotta try to be as good as possible.
You know when Clooney first started taking that kind of interest? On the Facts of Life set. He used to study how Mrs. Garrett approached her scenes.
Yes, and it's funny how many times he mentioned Mrs. Garrett. Just, you know, just when discussing a scene, he would say, I think Mrs. Garrett was going to do this. He would tell Vera that.
So, I mean, you can't always have Clooney in your movie.
Right.
So, at some point, you're going to have to deal with a real a-hole, I'm guessing. In one of these movies, you're going to do.
One day.
That's not going to be that fun.
No. Look, I've worked with nice people, and I've worked with difficult people. And I certainly don't enjoy working with difficult people. Certain directors do. There's directors who and
they
actors,
feed off it. It's almost like a relationship where you're attracted to a woman that you're fighting with. All
yeah,
the time.
But that happens in sports too.
Yeah,
you get players and coaches who butt heads, and that's part of their relationship. Like that's part of their magic, and that's how they get the best out of each other. And then there's coaches and players who just get along. You know, Phil Jackson doesn't go head to head with people as much. You know,
yeah.
He kind of has a laissez-faire attitude. And he presumes people will find their way. And
so,
then
what NBA coach would you compare yourself to?
Hold on.
That's a good question. You haven't gotten that one yet.
No, I haven't. That's an excellent.
Are you like a Doc Rivers?
I don't know.
Yell at the referees.
Does Doc Rivers yell at the referees
Greg
all the time?
Greg Popovich, maybe?
Honestly...
You pick a certain guy on the team to pick on?
If I could be compared to someone, Popovich would be pretty great. Because Popovich, first of all, has great taste in young talent and finding kind of players who kind of really kind of come into their own. He's a guy who puts kind of an interesting group of characters together.
Yes.
He's not a movie star based guy. He's on a all-star based. He's a guy who certainly has great players. Obviously Tim Gunn Dunk is a phenomenal player, but, the legacy of Popovich isn't a guy who's ridden Tim Duncan. The legacy of Popovich is a guy who somehow has created kind of an atmosphere of winners in which people unlikely, who you would never likely see together, frankly work great together.
He's a chemistry guy.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to be thought of as a Popovich.
As a chemistry guy?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty great. Look, I'm not Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson's this kind of strange Zen guy. I'm not, you know, George Carl. I'm not.
George Carl would be bad.
I'm not a player.
You'd be choking in the last 15 minutes every movie.
Every movie. I'm not a player coach. I'm not like an actor turned director.
Does it bother you that, because you're like a real director, like you actually like have been studying this since you were a kid and you went to film school and your whole life has revolved around, I'm going to direct movies.
I never went to film school.
You went to...
I was an English major.
I thought you went to film school.
No, I went to USC, and people presume when you go to USC that you went to film school.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I was actually an English
Bad
major.
Bad research by me.
No, that's perfectly fine. Well, look,
you didn't
look,
do film
that's
at
the joy
USC?
Of a podcast, is that we have time to kind of...
Show
like,
me, cut that. I don't want to look like a fool. I thought you did film at USC. Weren't you making movies
I
there?
I started making short films while I was there, but I was an
All
English
right.
major.
Bad assumption, by
No,
me.
My story is I...
I was a poli sci major in college.
Really?
I assume I was an English major.
There.
Yeah.
I created a desk calendar company while I was in college, and I was an English major and doing this desk calendar thing, and the desk calendar money paid for my first short film.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, back to my question that I screwed up. You're a real director. Like, you've put all kinds of thought into this, but yet sometimes with actors can decide, oh, I'm going to direct,
mm-hmm.
and then they direct, but they're not real directors who actually think about this stuff. Does that bug you? It would
you know,
be almost like a player like Tim Duncan saying, you know what, I'm going to coach now.
Right.
But not necessarily know how to coach.
I think similar to your sports analogy, there's players who make amazing coaches, and there's players who don't. The difference, often in sports I find it's not all stars who make great coaches.
Yeah.
It's guys who are kind of average players.
Gym rats.
Who have worked hard their entire life, who didn't have complete natural talent, but were always there, and who had just a great eye for the game and understanding for the game, and they made great coaches. There are movie stars who actually make really good directors, and George is a great director, frankly. But I don't know. You either kind of have that vision or you don't. It's funny. I was on a panel twice recently with Jim Cameron, Catherine Bigelow, Quentin Tarantino, Lee Daniels, and myself. And what directors get asked all the time is, why did you make this decision? Why did you make that decision? Why do this? Why do that? And the truth is, there's no good answer for any of these questions. The truth is, it's all based on instinct. And I would imagine if you asked a coach, no matter the sport, they would probably give you the same response. If they were honest, they'd say they have an instinct for why something is right. And they can't fully explain why it's the right decision. They just know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is no commonality between James Cameron, Catherine Bigelow, Quentin Tarantino, Lee Daniels, and myself. We are completely different people.
But what makes directing something that actors eventually, after they appear in enough movies, say, you know what? I can do this. Like, I remember 90210 started to go downhill when Jason Priestley started to direct. Well, it's like, hey, Jason, just play Brandon.
It's one of two things. Look, either they are an actor who just wants control and thinks they know better and doesn't want to be told what to do anymore.
Yeah.
Or there's someone with a vision and a story to tell, and they're actually a gifted director. And Clint Eastwood is a gifted director, and George Clooney is a gifted director. And it is quite a few of them out there who have a vision and really know what they're doing. So,
Well, there seems like there's two types of good directors, the guys who crank them out and the guys who pick their projects and throw their lives into them. And
I guess
it seems like you're in the latter, right?
But
you've
there's
only
people
done three
who direct,
movies in right. how many years?
Oh, I've moved fairly quickly. I make a movie every 2 years, and that's a pretty good...
But if you wanted, though, you could make your movie that you want to make every 2 years, but then you could also make like, oh, yeah, I'm doing Mission Impossible 5 for 2 months.
Right.
And they're paying me X million dollars. You don't do that, though.
No, I haven't sold out, and I tend to write my own work, so that takes longer. Yeah, could I do kind of just director for hire jobs in between the films that mean something to me? Yeah, and I could make some money doing it, but that doesn't interest me.
So Mission Impossible 5's out.
I don't think they would offer me Mission Impossible 5, but Mark Webb, who directed 500 Days of Summer, is going to direct the next Spider-Man movie. So
what?
Yeah, you never know. Maybe I'm missing my calling.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, right?
The one of the most fascinating things about you, if not the most fascinating thing, is that somehow you didn't become a celebrity kid.
Right.
We talked about this where
I'm constantly
ducking that. It could have gone that way, and it didn't happen.
Right.
Explain the tipping point that led to you going one direction, not the other.
Oh, I don't really actually want to get into the tipping point that...
all right, well, give us the...
Because it's really a girl, but... and I don't really want to get into that, but...
Do I want to start over?
No, that's fine. Frankly...
But why weren't you the kid...
Somehow I became self-aware in my late teens, and I became...
When were you the kid hanging out with the two Coreys at some nightclub when
you were
15?
Well, first of all, I wasn't cool. First of all, I was a genuine loser. I mean, I was just kind of... a video nerd, you know, a kid, you know, locked up in a video room editing the graduation video for the class, you know. That was my identity, and I wasn't a cool kid. Did not get invited to the parties. Never partied, never did any drugs. I've never even seen cocaine. Like, I really just somehow just wasn't invited. And
but your dad was one of the most powerful producers as you were growing up. Shouldn't you have fallen into that whole thing or no?
You know, it's people think that. I remember I went on Howard Stern once, and he asked me all about like the girls I got as a kid and things like that. And I just and I was almost upset at him because he painted a picture of a childhood that sounded much more fun than my actual childhood was. You know, these options somehow never made themselves available to me, and maybe it was by the good grace of my parents' good parenting that I somehow avoided all this stuff, and I do think my parents were actually really strong parents. And
so they're actually around, unlike out here a lot of times you see the famous parents, and they're like, oh yeah, we have two kids. Hey, we're going to Italy for right. 5 weeks.
No, my parents...
Try not to burn down the house.
My parents were very much around and very involved and very intent on me valuing money and valuing my good fortune to grow up the way I did, and... wanted me to find something to be passionate about for a living. And to a certain extent, my own drive took over. And that's something I can't speak to. And this you see in athletes all the time, where there's people who have fire and there's people who don't. There's people who are hungry and there's people who aren't. And I think I'm actually a good argument for the idea that somehow there is a kind of DNA element of hunger, because I have no reason to be hungry.
Yeah.
I grew up in Beverly Hills. I've never had to worry where my next dollar was going to come from. I really could have just cruised, you know, for the rest of my life. You know, my father told me at one point, look, if you want to go to college and just learn for the rest of your life, that's fine by me. And that I could have just, you know, hung out on college campuses and, you know, gotten degree after degree and never really kind of gone after anything. But I, by the time I was 18 or so, I just had drive and I wanted to achieve things.
Not to turn this into one of those terrible HBO therapy shows, but I do think the drive comes from the fact that you had your dad looming over you as the shadow and you're like, I want to be a director, but everybody is going to think I was the director because my dad got me the job. So I got to prove that I'm going to be actually a really good director. And
well,
maybe
that certainly is there. That's certainly there. And that's something for whatever reason, and maybe I need to go into therapy for it, but I am constantly conscientious of every single person who thinks that I got what I did because of my dad, because it's just not the case. And it's so funny. I can't explain.
That's not your fault, though. It's because it's other people have gotten whatever because of a relationship.
When you're the son of a famous director, people believe in you less. Like, I can't explain that well enough. That
yeah.
If you're the son of a famous director, they don't want to hand you things anymore. It's the opposite. They are much more skeptical. When you're the son of a famous director, people presume that you're going to be talentless.
Mm.
People presume that you're not going to be a hard worker, that you will not have the gifts that your parents did, that things came too easy to you, and because of that, you have no skill. So it's actually harder to get a job, oddly, because no one believes in you.
So there's your drive.
I think so. But then what would you say to the hundreds of other children of famous people who do nothing with their lives?
Oh, I think in this case you wanted to direct movies, but actually, as you said, it was a disadvantage that you were a famous person's son, and you had to constantly prove wrong.
Let me say something. There are advantages, but it's not the advantages that you think.
Right.
See, everyone presumes the advantage is that I call the head of some studio and say, I want to direct a movie, and he says yes. Couldn't be farther from the truth. In fact, my first film, Thank You for Smoking, nobody wanted to make. No studio would make. And it was an internet millionaire who finally, after like years, said, I will finance your film, Thank You for Smoking, with some guy from Silicon Valley. No studio would make it. The big advantage is I've been around films my entire life. I've been on sets my entire life. I've watched the screenwriting process my entire life. I've spent more time in editing rooms than anyone I've ever met. And because of that, I know how a film is made.
Yeah.
I know how you recover from your mistakes. I'm aware that directing is a job. Had I not grown up my father's son, I could really just think of movies as the kind, you know, this wonderful entertainment that seems to have too high a barrier of entry, that I would never think it was possible for me to be a director. Being my father's son, I thought, oh, that's a job and I can do it. And that's actually, I think, a huge advantage.
You've also put a ton of thought into, which I think is really interesting and I've never seen you talk about, so maybe you'll want to talk about it here, the arc of a director and
right.
How it's almost like an athlete where you have your prime, you have your wheelhouse, you have your, you know, like you can look at I don't know, Tim Duncan, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from 2002 to 2005, that was his absolute prime. That was his
right.
Apex.
Right.
And then this happened, and now we know his minutes are going to go down, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You feel like there's a similar career arc for directors, and I don't know, it's kind of sad. Like, you already feel like this is your prime, and maybe it's never going to get better than this.
Yeah, well.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, traditionally, directors make their most potent work in their, call it like 30s and early 40s, that oddly similar to an athlete, there's a moment where they're hungry and they're vital and they have enough anger and they have something to say. And because of that, they make unusual films, the kinds of films that usually speak to their career. And that doesn't mean they can not go on to make very good films. They can.
80% as good as the ones they made when they had that hunger.
They're missing something. For whatever reason, they don't become those Hallmark films that last for decades.
Yeah.
They don't have... There's something when you're younger, you have something to say. I think this, by the way, spans art forms.
Yeah.
But musicians tend to do their most vital work when they're young as well. But
you said that director age range, and yet you're younger than the age range, but your point is you're an old soul, so...
I somehow started earlier.
Yeah.
I start, and it's because I had a leg up in understanding how filmmaking worked.
Yeah.
And I just went after it really early. I had my first short film at Sundance when I was 19.
Right.
I was the youngest guy there. I was the second youngest member of the Directors Guild when I joined. I started directing commercials when I was 21. So, I mean...
So even though... What are you now, 33?
32.
32. Even though you're 32, biologically, you feel like you're older, and maybe if we were studying your career arc, it would be the career arc of somebody who would actually be 37, 38.
Yes. I think I'm about 5 years ahead of schedule.
But you're not old. You're not older like LeBron is, where LeBron says he's 25, but he's really 31.
No, no, I'm not actually 40. No, I'm actually 32. I presume that this next 10 years or so will be, and I'll make bad films the next 10 years too. But
I'm excited for them.
Yeah.
Can you make one with like a lot of nudity that's going to be on like at HBO at like 1 a.m?
Probably not.
Oh, come on.
That will probably happen later. When I run out of things to say.
It's a sexual thriller from the director of Juno.
Exactly.
And Up in the Air. So let's guess your next four movies. Is there a sports movie in there?
There's one that I'm working on. Working on a football movie.
A football movie?
Yeah.
How do you not do a hockey movie? You're freaking Canadian. Jesus, it's been 32 years since Slapshot.
I have an idea for a hockey movie. Frankly, hockey is tough because of Slapshot.
I don't buy that. I've heard that argument before. That's ridiculous.
I have an idea for a referee movie for hockey, but I haven't really kind of chewed on it much.
Is it, supposedly it's the Forget Paris of NHL movies.
Yes, that's it. But honestly, a Slapshot makes it difficult.
Come on. Nobody under 30, I think.
Bull Durham makes baseball difficult.
Yeah, that is true.
I think White Men Can't Jump and Hoosiers make basketball difficult. I mean, you have to think about these when you do a sports movie. This football idea is a strange one. It doesn't even take place in a modern football. So, and it's based on a short story, and I like it a lot.
It's not Leatherheads 2, is it?
It's Leatherheads 2.
Oh, so, I think that could work.
Thank you. I'm glad you believe it. I'm actually just about to start working on something that I can't talk about, but you and I have actually talked about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You before. Told me that one.
So,
yeah.
We in fact sold that yesterday.
Hockey.
Yes.
I don't buy your Slapshot thing, and it makes me mad.
Well, what? Okay, pitch me your hockey movie.
I don't know. I mean, well, first of all, you're telling me that if there was a really cool movie about a goon, a guy who his job is to fight the guys on the other team.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's coming out. It's called The Tooth Fairy with The Rock.
Oh, stop. Is that really a hockey goon movie?
The Tooth Fairy is about a guy who is a goon whose nickname is the Tooth Fairy because he knocks people's teeth out when he takes them out. He's such a jerk that he has to.
That's a kid's movie.
He has to become the actual Tooth Fairy. And
oh boy.
Yeah.
I tweeted a couple weeks ago that I want an intervention on The Rock's movie career. What is it about people have kids? They decide they're just going to make kids movies.
Does The Rock have
Eddie
kids?
Murphy. He must. Why else would he be in all these kids' movies?
Well, I think he's...
People want to be in kids' movies
so they can take
their kids and say, oh, look, that's...
I think The Rock has a very kind of specific target for his career. I think he's trying to kind of follow Schwarzenegger's footsteps. And Schwarzenegger did both family films and action films. And I think The Rock actually knows what he's doing.
You're saying The Rock studied the Schwarzenegger career path? The IMDb?
100%.
That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I know Will Smith did that with Alien movies. He, like, researched the top 12 grossing movies ever and noticed 8 of them had aliens. He was like, I want to start making alien movies.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
That's how I ended up in Men in Black and Independence Day.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I think I have no doubt that The Rock is actually very savvy about his career. You could just kind of feel it from him. And I think he's actually quite winning on camera. I think he's actually one of the good ones.
So you're saying he does smell what The Rock is cooking.
He does, actually. You know, he was suggested to me by his agents to play Nick Naylor in Thank You for Smoking.
That would have been interesting.
It would have been a different movie.
Here's my hockey pitch, which I just thought of 2 seconds ago. So you have the goon.
Right.
But it's really like, it's like about what this guy's life like.
Who do you picture as the goon?
I don't know, but I mean, you're a hockey guy.
Right.
The goons are fascinating because their fists only have so many punches in them. Because basically they're hitting guys in the helmet. So their knuckles become all messed up and they have to start taping them and they have this whole process. And they really only last like 3-4 years.
Right.
And their bodies start to break down.
Right.
But in those 3 and 4 years, they got to make the most of them. And every guy needs one. They get overpaid for. Now there's this guy in the Canucks that I'm fascinated by. Oh, what's his name?
Hey, I'm going to. Can I elaborate on your goon story?
Yeah, you take my thing and run it.
All right.
Run with it.
What I find interesting about the goon is that it is presumed that the goon is a monster, that he's this guy who just likes to beat people up, when it's actually usually very far from the case. The goons are actually usually the nicest person on the hockey team, and they're the guy you most want to grab a beer with, and they're the guy who goes and grabs a beer with the guy they beat up after
right.
the game. It's actually kind of the finesse players who could be more kind of tricky personalities are the French Canadians. The goons are protectors, and we forget that. The goons are the knights of hockey. They are the guys who are only there to make sure that these guys with natural talent who never had to work for anything in their lives
don't get effed with.
Don't get hurt.
Yeah.
And so the goon is usually a guy who was a very good hockey player, but not a brilliant hockey player, who, by virtue of his size and his nature to help people, has gotten into the position of protecting these kids with natural talent. And I would like to see a movie where you see a goon both in his real life and on the ice, who is kind of a softy, almost like the wrestler, who is a protector, who is broken, but who will do anything to protect the people around him.
See, I agree. That was basically the genesis.
That was the idea.
Well, here's the thing. The part that you left out is that there's a real sense of honor between the goons.
Right.
I would say it's the distant cousin of the token white guy on every NBA team when they see each other before the game. They're like, hey, what's happening, buddy? We're going out. The goons, it's like, oh, yeah, that's the only guy that understands what my life is like.
Right.
And also, when they have a fight, let's say somebody drops somebody or whatever, you never see, oh, I just knocked this guy down, like the UFC, I'm going to come in for the one last. Like, they'll just skate away and that's it. And I think that whole thing, I want to do a 30 for 30 on goons and nobody was with me.
Oh, really?
I wanted to take two guys on different teams like 3 weeks before they're about to play and follow each of them for that 3 weeks knowing that they're probably going to fight in that game.
Right.
They'll
definitely fight.
The X factor would be if they didn't fight, that would suck.
No, they really end up fighting in every game. And it's funny, I remember talking to a guy I played with in a charity game who was a former NHL player and a goon. And he told me about coming in his first year, and there was this kind of welcome to the NHL where he just got beaten up by a guy on every team. But by the end, and you remember, he said he remembered receiving his first NHL punch, and it was like unlike anything he'd ever felt in his life. He had gone through the college and junior hockey, and he'd beat people up, and he thought, you know, I'm a pretty tough guy. I can kind of take anything.
Yeah.
And then the first time he got slugged in the NHL, I was like, whoa!
Ouch!
Yeah, that's a real punch. And he remembers having to go through a season and face a guy on all 30 teams and take a real punch from each one of these guys. But by the end of that season, he realized that he could actually withstand each one of these guys. He won some, he lost some, but he could go toe-to-toe, and then that was kind of it.
You feel like hockey's on its way back a little bit.
I don't know, actually, if hockey's on its way back. I think it's a great sport. I enjoy watching it.
You don't think there's any momentum at all? Why did I think you thought that? I don't know.
I think they've done some smart things. I like the Winter Classic. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. Sadly, it's the only time mainstream people talk about hockey from October to March.
Yeah.
Is this one outdoor game, and all of a sudden it's this huge deal. But then, you know, like first it's the All-Star game. That doesn't get that attention.
I mean, they got some interesting players in the game right now. I think Ovechkin's really interesting.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I'm pessimistic.
I remember I was on a board in the NHL for a couple of years, and I told Kevin Smith what I was doing. He said, you're doing God's work, is how he described it. Like, what do you mean? I want to help. He's like, God's work, Jason. God's work. It's like, oh, thanks.
You are a Kings fan.
Yeah.
But you're from Canada. Explain yourself.
Okay. I was born in Montreal.
Yeah.
But I grew up.
You should be a Canadiens fan.
In Los Angeles. I spent my entire life in L.A. And when I met my wife.
When did you move from Montreal to Los Angeles?
6 months.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty young.
I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah, okay.
I don't remember living in Montreal.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't a sports bigamist.
No.
Okay.
Well, I'm a little bit of a sports bigamist, and I'll explain how.
All right.
When I met my wife, who is Canadian, she said, "So who's your favorite team?" And I said, "The Lakers." And she said, "You're not a real Canadian." And she basically, A, she wouldn't think of me as a Canadian, but B, she wouldn't date me, let alone have sex with me or marry me until I started playing hockey and following hockey. So she taught me everything I know about hockey following the Canucks, because she's from Vancouver and that's her team. Now, I am from Los Angeles, and I go to Kings games because I live in Los Angeles.
And you were here for Gretzky.
I was here for Gretzky, saw Gretzky play a bunch of times. So I am a Kings fan, but I also am a Canucks fan. I mean, I really learned to love the game following the Canucks. So I will cheer for the Canucks when they're playing. I cheer for the Kings when they play. And honestly,
but if they play in the Western Finals, you have to choose.
Yeah, I know, and I don't.
Don't
have
sit any... there like a president pretending you're rooting for both teams.
No,
I need you to pick a team. This is what happened to Tiger. This is when his life fell apart.
Right. Oh,
in the Orlando, but he also liked the Lakers, and he was going to the games, and he didn't know what hat to wear.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I'm convinced that the resulting karma led to all the problems he has right
really?
Now.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can't be a sports bigamist.
It's Western Conference Finals.
Yeah.
It's Game 7.
It's in L.A.
It's
surrounded by Kings fans.
It's Canucks and Kings.
You're sitting next to your wife.
Neither team has ever won the Cup.
Yeah. Which is amazing, by the way, that the Canucks haven't won.
Right. Canucks, the last time, you know, they went Game 7 against the Rangers.
Yeah.
That's when Messier won.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You don't have to pick. Maybe your next movie should be about a sports bigamist.
This is really tough. Like, honestly, I don't
know. You
know
what? It's probably one of those things that you won't know until you're at the game.
I'm at the game.
And you'll be leaning toward one of the teams.
Look, I guess I could say that in being in Los Angeles and getting to know some of the players, I feel like I have a more of a relationship with them.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see them win. I've gotten into Luke Robitaille. I'd love to see him win. I'd love to see him succeed in his new job.
So could cause some problems at home, potentially.
And then with the Canucks, they did get rid of some people that I really liked.
Yeah. All right, so you're a Kings fan.
I think so. Like they dropped Brian Burke, which I thought was so stupid. And I really liked Burke. He was the GM of the team up there.
And now he's the GM of the Maple Leafs.
Yeah, which that bothers me a lot.
He traded the Bruins 2 number ones for Phil Kessel. And
so you're not
now the Maple Leafs stink. And the Bruins, I hated the trade. I thought it was a sellout by the Bruins, but now it looks like the Bruins are going to get a top 5 pick. Yeah.
I really loved Bertuzzi. I know, you know, you get a lot of flack for saying that, but I really like Bertuzzi as a player. I'm really happy he found his place on the Red Wings. And I think that the people who are down on Bertuzzi just don't understand hockey and really don't understand that game in that moment and have just seen a TV clip and don't really understand what happened.
I think hockey players in general are fascinating. That's why when you said, like, Slapshot ruined the hockey movie.
It didn't ruin the hockey. It just makes it harder.
Or made it harder. I always thought they were the most interesting. First of all, they're beer drinkers, which, you know, what? Out of all the sports, they're the guys who go out and just throw them down. And
let's go through the four major sports for a second. NBA players are kind of so protected now that they cease to be interesting.
And they just hang out with the four people they grew up with for the most part.
Yeah, and it feels as though their team keeps them almost kind of hermetically sealed between games. Like they just, you know, they're not always successful.
We have to keep the population rate down.
But they really just... it feels as though they're not allowed to have personalities anymore because the David Stern's NBA is an NBA in which the players are characters and a large entertainment experience and they can't have personalities and it's strange when one actually breaks out to have a personality, and it usually has to do with them being very unusual or being a criminal. The NFL players are kind of a party. But you don't kind of get the thoughtful element of NFL players quite as much for
you know why? Because they're football players. We all went to college with them.
Right.
They're not rocket scientists for the most part.
I think baseball and hockey players are just a little more interesting. There's a reason why there's been so many movies about baseball. Certainly the life of a baseball player is interesting and kind of the length of it and the kind of the different acts of a baseball player's life. Hockey, I don't know. I think I'm biased. I just like hockey.
I think you could make the case that hockey players are... I hate to just totally generalize here. But it just seems like they've had nicer life experiences. Like in hockey, you know, you're playing in the minors and or juniors and you're living at somebody's house. You know, you're playing like Crosby lives at lived at Lemieux's house until he was 21. That would never happen in baseball.
Yeah, there's two sides to this though, because look, in one sense, yes, you're living in somebody's house, but in another sense, if you're a basketball player, at least you went to college. Hockey players in Canada at 16 leave their home.
Well, baseball too, for I'd say 60-70% probably have never seen a semester of college.
Right. And in hockey, you end up in like, you're in a farm town up in Canada.
Yeah.
Where you're basically a superstar at 16 years old. Not 18, like when you go to college, but like 16. You're still in high school.
Yeah.
And what I found with a lot of the hockey players I've met is that there is this kind of stunted growth when it comes to their kind of education and appreciation of culture and kind of how to exist in society. That there's kind of a strange thing where you could tell they stopped being part of normal life at 16.
I think that goes for baseball as well, although maybe it's 18 instead of 16. But you've seen it with all the PEDs and all the stuff that's happening. It's these guys, it's just, they don't think of it beyond just, oh, I need to be better. That's like the incredible, I need to get better. Give me that. And they're not really putting any real thought into it. Like McGuire's answer is about, it was low dosage. Well, it didn't help me at homers. It just helped me recover. Like, no, actually it did help you. Like he was so dense about it. It made me think, do these guys even like understand what they did and what they did to the game?
Do you want to talk about steroids for a second? Do you want to get into that? Oh, no, I can't. I have to go. I'm already supposed to be there. I'm like late.
Oh my God.
Oh.
We got to wrap up.
Let's
wrap
it
up. You got to do Tavis Smiley.
To go to the Tavis Smiley show.
We're so similar. It's going to be the exact same experience.
I think I'm sufficiently prepped, and I presume I'll get the same exact questions.
We'll get you get 20 seconds in the Lakers. We never did the Lakers.
Oh, yeah.
You're feeling good.
Yeah. You know, look, it's a strange thing being a Lakers fan. And I only realized this once I started following hockey, because I started following hockey and I started to hate the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, these Leafs fans are so arrogant. And I remember my uncle, who's a Leafs fan, sent me a Leafs jersey. And I was like, why would you even think I would wear a Leafs jersey?
Yeah.
I'm a Kings fan, a Canucks fan. That's just a Leafs fan mentality.
Yeah.
And that's when it hit me. Oh, this is how people think of me as a Laker fan.
Yeah.
They presume the same arrogance. They presume that, you know, it's just we don't appreciate when we're good. And there are a lot of great Laker fans.
I know Laker history. You're one of the Laker fans I like.
I've gone to Laker games my whole life. I have the same time. You know, I mean, one of my favorite things to read from you is when you talk about you and your dad. I'm sure you get a lot of fan mail that says the same. Because we all relate to that. That sports is one of the great bonding experiences between father and son. And look, even in a movie family, like I remember my dad and I kind of standing on our couch as Magic hit the hook, you know, like I have all these moments. I remember my dad taking me down to Laker games. It was the one time I was allowed to have Kentucky Fried Chicken for some reason. My dad would take me down to the Forum and we'd stop at KFC and get some Kentucky Fried Chicken. We'd, you know, fried chicken and we'd go watch a Laker game. And I, you know,
And he had good tickets, I bet, occasionally.
Oh, amazing seats. Yeah. No, we would get his agency. We'd sit on the floor next to the Laker girls. I mean, it was spectacular.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's why he didn't have a girlfriend. He had the Laker girls.
Yeah. there are good Laker fans.
Yeah.
But I still understand the perception now, because now I know how I feel about the Leafs, and in that sense, I know how people feel.
When do the Oscar nominations come out?
First week of February.
Good luck. Jason Reitman, up in the air. Go see it. My favorite movie of 2009.
Hey.
No, it was. Hey.
Appreciate it.
It was good. All right. Thank you.
All right.
So I get to sign off.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news. Subway is home to the famous $5 footlong. So celebrate your favorite Subway famous $5 footlong, like the classic BLT or the Big Bowl Black Forest ham and cheese. All stacked your way with the meats, cheeses, and fresh crisp veggies you love.